dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. For some time now, various government officials and officials emeriti have been engaged in efforts purporting to get to the bottom of the so-called intelligence failures leading up to the attacks of 9/11. These investigations have failed to address almost all of the key questions surrounding the events of 9/11. The official investigators have been bullied by and or obsequious to the very officials whose actions prior to, during, and subsequent to the attacks ought to be meticulously examined. Many people believe that these official proceedings are a window dressing for a cover-up, and the stonewalling of the Bush administration every step of the way has led many a reasonable person to conclude that every effort is being made to hide the truth. Since the 9/11 attacks, independent researchers and journalists, families of victims, and concerned citizens who can't swallow the official story have formed an international movement known as the 9/11 Skeptics Movement. Late last March, key researchers and members of the public came together in San Francisco for the International Inquiry into 9/11. For the next month, I'll be bringing you presentations from this citizens' inquiry, which has received little press coverage, though nothing is more deserving of center stage in the national dialogue. That is, if we had a national dialogue, instead of a corporate-controlled monologue. This is the statement of goals of the citizens' inquiry that we're about to hear. Whereas the tragic events of 9/11 have been used by the United States government to justify a war upon the world, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. Whereas the Joint House and Senate inquiry of September 11, 2001, and the Independent National Commission on Terrorist Attacks have not served to reveal the truth about the events of September 11, 2001, but to justify increasing the power of the national security state. Whereas the mass circulation press in the United States has failed to ask the most basic questions about what actually happened on September 11, 2001, and has supported the extension of U.S. military might throughout the world. We, who question the official narrative of September 11, 2001, and question the path the U.S. government has chosen in its wake, believe a public inquiry asking who, what, how, when, and why into those events is vitally necessary. Therefore, this inquiry intends to bring together independent researchers, questioners, seekers of evidence, authors, filmmakers, to share what they have learned with the world, and all who desire and work to discover the truth about September 11, 2001. Our hope is to create a safe space for new witnesses and testimony to come forward, and to deepen the common understanding of the enormously complex events that preceded, occurred on, and followed the attacks of September 11, 2001. Evidence suggests that September 11, 2001 was a special operation designed to terrorize Americans into silent conformity, to legitimize the crushing of dissent throughout the world, and to gain public support for imperial wars. Our hope is to disempower the war game once and for all by exposing the criminal actions of those in power who committed crimes against humanity to advance that power.
My name is Nick Levice. I was born and grew up in New York City, and I've moved back there recently. I have always taken an interest in history and politics in an academic way, which is a great way to learn a lot of things and be completely unemployable. I co-authored and edited a collection of academic studies about the relationship between the American corporations Ford and General Motors and the Nazi Reich, and how Ford and General Motors collaborated with the Nazis and helped build their war machine, also used forced labor, and this past Pearl Harbor. So this book was called Working for the Enemy, and I think that's a very appropriate title for a lot of things. This is how I began to learn, or this was one step in learning, about how often it's been the case that great powers like the United States create their own enemies, create the enemies of necessity to justify the political programs and the wars that they feel they need to get through, that the elites in these countries feel are necessary. I also followed for a long time everything that was happening with the Bush presidencies, which I guess really started with Reagan in 1980. And I saw how in the 1980s, they were able to get away with secret wars in Central America and Afghanistan and support both Iraq and Iran at the same time in that 10-year war. I saw how they were able to bring drugs into the country, how it got revealed so many times, already starting in the early 80s, that the Contras were bringing cocaine into the country, another long history. And they were our allies, and that was cool, and they had the cover of the CIA. So I've seen, I'm not that old, but I'm old enough now to have seen enough of this history that actually it's kind of the same thing over and over, that, our government seems, or an important wing of our government, the covert wing, the secret government, seems to create all the problems that then need solving by the same government, by the open wing. So we bring in the drugs, or one wing brings in the drugs and the other wing enforces the drug laws. And thanks to Prohibition, we've got this massively profitable industry and all this money laundering, and the CIA is able to finance all its covert operations. That's a very corrupt system. And it's been like that for a very long time. And not only is it a corrupt system, it's a very unstable system. And I think we are witnessing how this system has reached a kind of point of terminal crisis, where there will be nothing but crisis for this system from now on. And a system in terminal crisis, for those elites who wish to maintain it, is going to need events, engineered events, and that can justify its continued existence. And it's going to need the enemies to justify its continued existence. So to make a long story short, when I saw that another Bush, that the son of Bush was going to get into power, that they actually stole the election on his behalf, I was not particularly surprised then later when a Reichstag fire type of event happened. I was expecting it. It was not a surprise to me, unfortunately, for these reasons that I've described. And it was, of course, the first hunch that I had, that this must be exactly that event that I was expecting. But I also had my doubts. I needed to research this along with many other people. We found ourselves tracking down all the little stories that were out there, all the little glimpses that we caught into the reality of September 11th, about the Air Force stand down, about all the advance warnings. And we found ourselves on the internet, basically, trying to connect somehow at some point, because it became increasingly obvious that the government is in some way complicit in September 11th. And that has become constantly ever more obvious, especially through the continuous obstruction of every effort at investigation, at every effort to answer all the questions that have been raised. It started already on September 11th, this cover-up. Already on the morning of September 11th, the lobbyists were in Washington trying to get through a plan under which the United States would pick up the costs of compensating the victims, and in exchange, the victims would agree or the victims' families would agree not to pursue litigation against the United States or American-owned companies. This victims' fund was the first element of the 9/11 cover-up, and it was a very important element because the families are actually being compensated very well, an average of $1.8 million, possibly better than they could do through litigation. But the normal process is litigation, and the insurance companies have to decide, and ultimately people do get their compensation. But in that process, there is discovery. We find out things about what really happened. And that process has been entirely subverted by these unprecedented laws that were created by this Feinberg Fund. And you will be hearing about that, a great deal about that, from Ellen Mariani, who has decided to not take the $1.8 million from the government. She doesn't need the hush money. She wants the truth. And so she's suing the government. She has forgone the compensation. And she will be speaking along with her attorney, Phil Berg. So that was the beginning, but it has never stopped. For 2.5 years, we've seen continuous obstruction. What we've seen is, do you remember the anthrax? Who did it go to in the Congress? It went to the Democratic leadership. Then later, when this Democratic leadership was kind of thinking, gee, should we investigate 9/11, at a time when they were doing everything Bush wanted, Cheney and Bush both went to Tom Daschle, who was still the head of the Senate and the head of our former opposition, and said, don't go there, you don't want that. It took all this pressure from the victims' families because they started organizing themselves before we had even the congressional investigation. The congressional investigation was led by Senator Graham and Representative Porter Goss. Now, the interesting thing about this, I think all you really need to know is that on the morning of September 11th, they were meeting with the head of Pakistani intelligence, Mahmoud Ahmad. And later we found out that he was the money man behind September 11th, that his agency wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta. What's interesting about the congressional investigation is that at no point is anything about Pakistan mentioned about this Pakistani connection, and yet the two primary investigators, Bob Graham and Porter Goss, were meeting with the head of the ISI on the morning of September 11th. What is he doing in Washington on the morning of September 11th? He's meeting his counterpart, Tenet, he's meeting the national security officials, and you know, at the same time, his agency is supporting the alleged hijackers, and this is not a story. This was briefly a story in the Wall Street Journal because they lost the reporter, Daniel Pearl, who was investigating this among other stories. He was investigating the ISI connections to terror. So that's so much for the congressional inquiry. Not only that, you know, that congressional inquiry reached a low point in the summer of 2002 when the FBI, which the congressional inquiry was supposedly investigating, demanded that the senators on the panel take lie detector tests and went and searched the Senate offices. The FBI is intimidating the supposed investigators. They release an 800-page report, and what do we have out of this report? Well, maybe 3/4 of it, because 1/4 is redacted. It's just black magic marker. A whole chapter is redacted. A glossary item is redacted. I want to know, what is this glossary item? Some secret agency of the government that we're not even supposed to know exists? It's, you know, that was so much for the congressional inquiry. Now, at the beginning of the congressional inquiry, Kristen Breitweiser, who lost her husband on September 11th and who is with the Families Steering Committee, who are tracking the investigations and who have been posing the questions, she spoke to the Congress. She spoke to the panel, and she brought up all these questions that they did not touch again. Then came part three of the farce. After the Victims Fund and the congressional investigation, we finally got a commission. 14 months later. Now, normally, you get a commission for something like September 11th on the next day. The space shuttle, they agreed there's going to be a commission on the space shuttle immediately. They got $30 million to investigate the space shuttle explosion. How much did they spend on pursuing Bill Clinton's sexual affairs in the 90s? For the September 11th commission, when they finally agreed to have one, first they said $3 million is all that they want to give up for it, for this so-called investigation, and then Bush tried to appoint Henry Kissinger to lead it. That was November 2002. That already should have been red flag enough for the media to say, for everyone to say, they are covering up something much worse than mere incompetence. Because if it was incompetence, they would have pursued they would have found out who had been incompetent, and they would have seen these guys off. But instead, we see that all of the major officers who were responsible on September 11th itself for air defense, General Myers and General Eberhardt, at the FBI, a certain Dave Frasca and others who were blocking the FBI investigations that could have caught the alleged hijackers, these people were all promoted. Okay, so the people who are responsible are promoted. There is no real investigation, and they try to put Kissinger in charge. Well, everybody left the whole world round, and as a result, Kissinger decided that he didn't really want to be exposed in this fashion. He'd have to reveal who his clients were. So they went and got Tom Keene. It turns out Tom Keene sits on the board of an oil company that does business with Bin Laden brothers. It turns out that the executive director of the Keene Commission, which is in the headlines right now, right? They're getting to the bottom of September 11th. They'll leave no stone unturned, blah, blah, blah. The executive director of the Keene Commission, that is the guy who controls all of the information that the Keene Commission sees. Okay? He's the chief of staff. He decides what they're going to, what their agenda is going to be, what information they're going to see. His name is Philip Zelikow, and he co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice. He was on the National Security Staff in the transition between Clinton and Bush, and he was at a bunch of meetings apparently relating to terrorism. And you know what? The Keene Commission called him as a witness. Okay, this guy is testifying before the commission, and at the same time, he is running the commission. It doesn't really surprise me that the families have demanded his resignation. Have you heard about this? The Family Steering Committee is this demanding the resignation of Philip Zelikow? Is this in the papers? No. This is a farce. One of the commissioners was Max Cleland, former senator from Georgia. And in November of 2003, just last year, just a few months ago, Max Cleland, who was on the commission, suddenly said he doesn't want to accept the deal that they had cut with the White House to suppress the key documents about advance knowledge of September 11th, about what warnings exactly Bush had gotten. He didn't want to look at partial information, and he said some very interesting things. He said, every day we find out this government knew more about these terrorists in advance than they have ever admitted. He's on the commission, and obviously he's resigning, and that's exactly what he was doing just at that moment. He was saying Bush is scamming America. He also said, this is just like the Warren Commission. They messed up because they used partial evidence. I don't want to mess up like the Warren Commission. Just as Max Cleland is saying all this, the same Bush who is scamming America turns around and appoints Max Cleland to be head of the Export-Import Bank. And Max Cleland goes off to his new job as a bank director, which prevents him from being on the commission. And this is not treated as a story. This does not exist in the press. The press simply continues to pretend that there is a real investigation going on, that this commission is for real. It was on Democracy Now. I'm sorry. When I talk about the press just now, I meant actually the mainstream press, the mass media. Okay? They are not covering it, and unfortunately, that's what constitutes reality for possibly a majority of our fellow country persons. So, what do we see from all this? You know, the commission just had this set of hearings where they had, okay, I'll be done shortly. The commission just asked Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld just testified, and he said, no one could have imagined that anyone would use planes as weapons against buildings. Okay, except that everybody had imagined this in advance. How can he still get away with this lie? How can Condoleezza still get, Rice still get away with this lie that no one could have imagined it? It's nuts because at the July 2001 Genoa summit, we know that Bush spent the night on the aircraft carrier with Condoleezza Rice because they were afraid that Osama bin Laden would crash a plane into his hotel. Okay, that was the official story. That was in Time magazine. So this is why there is a 9/11 truth movement, if you're wondering, because it's just left to us. There is nobody else that's going to investigate September 11th until we can put up the kind of pressure that is necessary to stop the cover-up. And that means all of you have to take this seriously. All of you have to educate yourselves as much about the details as you can. I know it's not always the most exciting stuff to get into the tiniest details of who, what, when, where, but it's necessary. We are stuck doing this investigation ourselves, and we are stuck generating the political pressure that is necessary until we get a real investigation with real subpoena power. And that means stuff like what we're doing in New York City. We are at ground zero every week with a banner that says, stop the 9/11 cover-up, support victims' families. And we're doing our best to see to it that people at least find out what the victims' families who are actually looking at September 11th, who have refused to take the government payoff, are saying. They're demanding that Bush answer 23 questions, and, you know, I urge you all to find out about their work. Okay, and one more thing I'd like to say is...
Nicholas, you're out of time.
One more thing I'd like to say is the Berlin Conference was an international conference. It had a lot of the people who were here as well. We had Michael Rupert, we had Cynthia McKinney as the keynote speaker. It was heavily covered in the German press. It is possible to get traction on this issue outside the United States. We are not alone. We should be reaching out as much as possible to all the people around the world who are doubting the official story. You know, it is not exotic to them in Germany that there would be a Reichstag fire, right? And you can read about the results of the conference and the seven questions that we posed, on which we are going to build upon during this inquiry, in the booklet.
Thanks, Nick. And I'd like to introduce actually our MC, Barry Zwicker, who produced The Great Deception, which was, you know, the landmark investigative journalistic effort, which of course was the only nonprofit, non-corporate television station in Canada, not the United States. And he's a great hero, and he's organizing the Toronto Inquiry, phase two of the International Inquiry into 9/11. Barry Zwicker.
Okay, thank you very much. I have been asked, as Carol said, to be the MC after I have the privilege of 10 minutes to share some thoughts that I've been asked to address, to bring to you on the question, where are we now? And Carol didn't specify who we is or anything. I guess now is clear enough. And I'm going to just set this little timer up for 10 minutes and press start. And that thing goes beep, I'm out of here, to bring the next presenter. And I'm going to follow a script that I have written out. I hope I read well enough not to be boring just as a reader. Where are we now? Where are we going? Let me start with the we being our species, but not forgetting other life on Earth. And later, I'll mention we as 9/11 skeptics. But let me start with the largest canvas that I can grasp. We are literally in the universe. The universe is the ultimate reality, as ecologian Thomas Berry puts it. The only text without context, the universe. Now, I've got reasons for mentioning this, not just because I'm in California. Speaking of the universe, how many people here saw or heard of the latest data gathered by the Hubble telescope? Put your hands right up. Okay, that's good. Maybe it's a quarter of the people here, but the other three quarters have been robbed. Let me share a few quotes from the Toronto Sunday Star of March 14th from the astronomy column. On Tuesday, this article reads, astronomers at the Space Telescope Science Institute unveiled the deepest portrait of the visible universe ever achieved by humankind. Called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, HUDF, the exposure reveals the most remote galaxies yet seen, roughly 13 billion light years away. The HUDF field covers a patch of sky about the size of a pinhead held at arm's length. That field contains an estimated 10,000 galaxies, and each galaxy contains approximately 100 billion stars, and the whole sky contains 12.7 million times more than that pinhole. Now, in my opinion, that should be front page news for the human race. But staying with amazing numbers, this news was given perhaps 1/100,000th the coverage of Janet Jackson's breast flash. And in that coverage, the main thing exposed was the value system of the mainstream media, to which I will return and which Nick mentioned, which it is Nick, isn't it? Yeah, thanks. Awesome as it may be, this information from the Hubble, what, you ask, does this have to do with 9/11 and this inquiry? Well, a great deal. NASA, much of its value system borrowed from or imposed by the current rulers of this country, plans to pull the plug on the Hubble telescope program, which costs a fraction of any, almost any U.S. military program you can name. In other words, a human endeavor which expands our knowledge of our ultimate reality is considered an expendable frill by those who control the most power and resources on this planet. I can never get used to that. Where is the human species now? Well, as Professor Michel Chasidovsky of the University of Ottawa usually says at the start of his talks, we are at the most dangerous point in world history. That could be arguable, but I think it's probably true. We are in a multiple crisis. Above all, it's ecological. And you cannot have a healthy human economy based on a sick earth economy. So the economic crisis is additionally one of extreme inequitability. We are in a related social crisis. There's a communications crisis. The public nervous system is sending false signals. It is not a spiritual crisis, in my opinion, perhaps the opposite, because crisis forces deep reassessment for individuals, organizations, and planets. The human species could find its soul restoring its home, or we may all die sooner than we should, or both. Another way of describing where we, the people, are is to say we are collectively brainwashed semi-automatons being force-marched toward extinction by rulers who are tunnel vision bullies and moral zeros. Their latest, greatest hit was 9/11. So the rulers ordered their apparatchiks to mount some encores, the latest being the Madrid train bombings, quickly dubbed Europe's 9/11. A telltale fingerprint was the alleged finding of a Koran in a van soon after. Come on. And the alleged tape linked to Al-Qaeda. Come on. The purpose of 9/11 and encore 9/11 type events is to keep the public malleable through fear. A fearful public will countenance a reduction of its liberties in return for promises of greater security. More encores are expected. I hope this will be the subject of much discussion at this inquiry. Question: how often can they play this Koran in a van card before the pattern recognition becomes so widespread among citizens on the planet as to become a serious political force? 9/11 actually was, in my opinion, a sloppily complicated drama that well reflects the diseased minds that concocted it. They can get that complicated because their resources are virtually unlimited and their moral restraints nil. They are diabolical technicians getting off on their power and perversity and propensity to please their masters. But if the 9/11 planners have been high-fiving over their success, they're engaging in hubris, taking credit where it is not due. Because those who conspired to concoct this toxic trick and inflict it did not succeed because they created a seamless magic trick, they succeeded only because of the virtual total complicity of the mainstream media, our mental jailers. And I'm so glad Nick brought that up. It's from the mainstream media that most people get most of their information most of the time on most subjects. So those who control the output of the mainstream media control the brainstem of our collective consciousness. When those charged with being skeptical inquirers are neither skeptical nor do they inquire, the only phrase for it is deep complicity. When investigative journalists fail to investigate the obvious, it is deep complicity. When investigative journalists only investigate that which distracts the public from the obvious, it is even deeper complicity. When those in the news business take seriously a limited hangout a la Richard Clark, it is deep complicity. It reminds me of the Vietnam War era. If Clark were operating back then, he would be saying, Bush is not sufficiently interested in prosecuting the war. And Bush would then respond, he darn well is. And left unaddressed would be the immorality of the Vietnam War. The whole debate around Clark's current contentions is a false drama played out in the arena of the big lie. The drama, however transfixing to the bemused masses, validates the big lie. As author and activist Arundhati Roy writes, in the current issue of Global Outlook magazine, the magazine of our movement, quote, "It is important to understand the corporate media do not just support the neoliberal project. They are the neoliberal project. It is structural. It's intrinsic to the economics of the mass media." And the mainstream media, I speak as someone who earned his living for 33 years as a media critic, the mainstream media perform as spear carriers for their emperor through a combination of de facto censorship, mass distraction, and platforming of ideologically loaded deceptions. All blend into the illusory landscape of the total synthetic environment, which is their penultimate product. Their ultimate product is atomized, lobotomized masses existing in their consumer-decorated assigned pigeonholes, and in fact, all of us to one extent or another. But there's another answer to the question. Where are we now, and where are we going? I think that now we are actually on the threshold of hope, because such an edifice of illusion embedded in and promotive of an earth-destroying economy is one which cannot be sustained. Something has to give, and give soon. The depletion of resources is proceeding exponentially. The buildup of wastes is proceeding exponentially. The brazenness of deceptions manufactured to mobilize public opinion behind the agenda of the neocons is reaching a zenith. Another outrage is widely predicted to occur between now and November, as you know. Something is stirring among the masses designated to sleepwalk toward oblivion. Something is stirring even among some of the prison guards, even among a few of the illusioneers. So where are we in the 9/11 skeptics movement? Well, I think our job is to know the landscape as well as we can, to grasp the largest picture to the best of our ability, to plan, as Michael Rupert says, a roadmap from where we are to a better place. Our job is to nourish realistic hope that we can and will, as 9/11 skeptics, play a pivotal role in helping the old death system to itself die the death it unconsciously seeks. Our job is to prepare for the chaos to come and help lay the groundwork for the more honest and sane world that will be built upon the rubble and courage of the present. As 9/11 skeptics, we are called by history to be our best and most effective selves, whatever role we play. We are charged with doing our utmost to save our planetary home. And to paraphrase the poet who stood on this stage in February, our great-grandchildren should not let us sleep at night. So that's where I think we 9/11 skeptics are now. We are more awake than we ever have been. We have much more waking up to do, and especially we owe it to our fellow citizens to rub the sleep out of our eyes. Out of their eyes. That was 10 minutes exactly. Okay. It's my pleasure, although I don't have nearly as much information as I would like to have about the next speaker, to introduce Gray Brecken. And he's probably well known to many of you here, much better than he's known to me here, as the author of Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. And I've learned he is a professor of geography and history. Those are his disciplines, and he was on the staff, an adjunct professor at Cal. And I'll be interested to meet Gray Brecken, and especially to hear him, and he should appear from behind the screen in a moment.
Thank you. By the way, 59 years ago, the United Nations was formed here, actually, and just last year, people who always hated the idea of that institution pretty much killed it, in fact, and that has a lot to do, of course, with what we're here for today. Well, I want you to imagine that you are looking at history and almost everything else that humans do in a very uncustomary way, as if you were looking at the world through polarized lenses. For a little bit, bear with me, we're going to look at history as flows of energy. How many times recently have we been told that we're engaged in unremitting warfare between good and evil, between light and dark, between civilization and barbarism, but not in terms of energy? And we know which side we're on. We're on the side of civilization, since we represent its apex. And so it's only appropriate that America, still young and virile and as resolute in purpose as when first set upon its great destiny by the Founding Fathers, should have returned a year ago to the place where civilization began in the Fertile Crescent, in Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers. We brought civilization back to where it began, but then somehow it went bad while we went good. We brought light to what had gone dark. We come to liberate the people and, incidentally, to help them develop the energy that lies under their wrecked and now radioactive soil. One could regard civilization, like humanity, indeed like all of life itself, as a constant quest for energy. The difference, however, between ourselves and your average fern or hawk or platypus is that they use only as much energy as they need to live and to reproduce themselves. They know the meaning of enough. They don't build cities or empires where there is never enough. To civilize means literally to citify, and Mesopotamia is where cities first appeared, and it shows. By now you've probably gotten used to those scenes of bleak devastation that you've seen on television, not the ones that Saddam Hussein or the Taliban made or that we are making, but the landscape created thousands of years ago by cities which are now piles of mud and artifacts currently being looted to decorate apartments and mansions in today's imperial cities. Those Mesopotamian cities rose upon the surplus energy made possible by irrigated agriculture, which in turn made possible the division of labor, accounting, hierarchies, writing, leisure time, sciences, arts, architecture, and of course war, in order for the elites of those cities to get still more energy. At its very simplest, warfare is a vast expenditure of energy used to get more energy with which to fight more wars and so on. Much of that energy consists of the labor of humans and animals fueled by carbohydrates, and that usually means topsoil. But throughout most of history, it has also meant wood, and the quest for forests for fuel and building material has been one of the chief stimuli to expansion and conquest. The fate of forests, soils, and cities are thus intimately linked. They're entangled throughout history in ways that often only the wisest understood. Plato, for example, knew that Greece had once been covered by forests, which had nourished rivers and springs all year round, but that in his own time, the land looked like the body of an emaciated person wasted by disease. Greece had been emaciated by its cities and by its quest for empire. He was looking at the consequences of an unremitting quest for energy. By that time, the Fertile Crescent was no longer very fertile. It was well on its way to becoming the salty desert that we see now because of the demands made upon it by Babylon, Nineveh, and other fabled cities. Imperial Rome, in its turn, would be literally buried about 20 feet deep by soil washed off the deforested Apennines. Its appetite would waste North Africa, Spain, and everywhere else around the Mediterranean called upon to send it tribute. And yet we did get something in return for all that energy extracted from the earth and from the sun and concentrated in a few great cities. The lights went on. We created art and we created cities. We created knowledge and we stored it as we stored energy in granaries. We created libraries. But those libraries were not for us, they were for them. The elites who built and ran the cities and their empires knew that knowledge is power, and so they kept it for themselves. For us, they concocted belief systems that sent us to wars to get more energy for themselves. They created some of the most cockamamie belief systems, some of the most cockamamie religions you can imagine, to motivate thousands of little people to build temples and palaces and tombs and to go to war to get more energy with which to build and to accumulate more. Enough was a word that they have never added to their vocabularies. Nonetheless, they built some wonderful places. I'm going to go way out on a limb and say that I've always believed that Venice is in fact a more beautiful and ingenious place than, say, Phoenix or even Las Vegas. It became that way because in 1204, Venice's rulers diverted the Fourth Crusade away from the Holy Land to besiege and sack the ancient city of Constantinople, a Christian city like Venice. Venice took much of the loot and 3/8 of the Byzantine Empire to begin making its own empire. It had formerly been part of that empire. God, of course, was on its side. And to this day, there are people in Istanbul who hate Venice for what it did to their city 800 years ago. Much of what was the Venetian Empire is a desert today because of the energy that it took then. Memories are long in that part of the world, and we forget that at our own peril. It happens over and over again. God is forever on the side of the victor, or the losers did something bad to merit his disfavor. History becomes a litany of wars fought in his name, masking the constant quest for yet more energy. And then, in the 18th century, something different happened. We call it, as sort of shorthand, the Enlightenment. A group of philosophers, mainly in snooty old France, proposed that humans could organize themselves in a different way, and the U.S. is the product of that. Chiefly, the founders proposed that people could rule themselves, but to do so, they would have to have access to the information that had formerly been monopolized by the few, and particularly by the priests. Government would not only be representative, but it should be transparent, so as to keep it honest and free of the tyranny to which it naturally would tend. Hence, we have freedom of the press, hence separation of church and state, hence libraries. And so Thomas Jefferson created a library which he made the centerpiece of his University of Virginia, and he started the Library of Congress. These were largely to enlighten the many. And these really, I think, represent a significant step forward in civilization. Now, these were noble ideals, but they were often more honored in the breach. The country and the cities grew, and as they grew, they required more energy, which they took from more distant sources, often by force. Because there was no state religion, there had to be some other motivating ideal by which large numbers of men would march or sail off to distant places to take and add them to what has often been referred to, or was at that time, as the Empire of Liberty. In 1845, a journalist named John O'Sullivan coined the phrase Manifest Destiny to describe why the U.S. must stretch from sea to shining sea and then some. Manifest Destiny was code for God. While few bothered to ask how O'Sullivan or the politicians who used that term had channeled the deity and knew what he wanted for his chosen people, what he wanted them to do. At that time, what God apparently wanted was for the United States to attack its weak neighbor, Mexico, and take its northern half. God wanted the U.S. to have San Francisco Bay as its strategic gateway on the Pacific. But along with the bay came an enormous amount of real estate, gold, silver, copper, fine soils, and a huge surplus of energy, which would go a long way to making the U.S. a superpower in the 20th century. The glittering charm of Manifest Destiny was that it was so unmanifest that whenever called upon, it could justify taking all of Mexico, Canada, the Caribbean, the Western Hemisphere, and finally the Pacific Ocean itself. Stabs were made at all of these until 1898, just 50 years after the war with Mexico, when Manifest Destiny made a spectacular encore after a U.S. warship called the Maine mysteriously exploded in Havana Harbor, allowing the U.S. to righteously declare war on Spain and then to take most of its remaining overseas territories. What happened in 1898 and afterwards is remarkably similar to what we are going through right now. What few Americans knew was that the war on Spain had been planned by a few men well before the Maine exploded. It was simply an excuse. The idea was to get the Philippines and Guam and annex Hawaii in order to control the Pacific Ocean. It was often said at that time that whoever controlled the Pacific Ocean would control the world. There was, however, a large fly in that ointment. The Filipinos didn't want to be occupied by another colonial power, and they fought back. The splendid little war soon turned into a very dirty, long war with no exit strategy and thousands of dead, diseased, maimed, and mentally wrecked sailors and soldiers returning to the homeland, while the Philippines, in turn, were simply wasted by scorched earth policy. It was a potential public relations disaster, so pundits were duly rolled out to explain it in the usual terms of bringing light to the dark places of the earth. Rudyard Kipling wrote The White Man's Burden to steel Americans to what they had to do in order to bring civilization to the dark places. God was by no means gone, but increasingly humanity and civilization and team spirit would stand in for him. Secretary of War Elihu Root assured Americans that the warfare has been conducted with marked humanity and magnanimity. San Francisco historian Hubert Howe Bancroft wrote, "It was worth to Spain all it cost in delivering her from her unprofitable colonies, and it was worth to the United States many times its cost as an object lesson teaching men how to kill their fellow men gracefully, humanely, and in all Christian charity. Never before was seen in war such zeal and patriotism, unattended by enmity, and where there was such an absence of any desire to inflict wanton injury upon the enemy." The Reverend Dr. Kirby told a rally of Methodist ministers in San Francisco that the Lord Jesus Christ is behind the bayonets. So you see that, in fact, our age has no monopoly on silliness. Most importantly, Americans were repeatedly told that their country, unlike any other then or ever before, had been inoculated by its founding ideals from error or evil, and those such as Mark Twain were just plain wrong, if not downright seditious. As the war in the Philippines dragged on, Professor Bernard Moses, who founded the Department of Political Science at the University of California, assured doubters that the patriotism of the American people is to make impossible the realization of the dreams of the prophets of evil, and backed by the morality and manhood of this nation is to lead it in the way that is right. Imagine, all of this was before movies. Just imagine the certainties that you could implant in minds using Jimmy Stewart or John Wayne or a Wolf Blitzer or a Thomas Friedman. Now, I'm going to skip over the most of the next century, or we'd never get out of here. And actually, Barry's documentary did a very good job of giving you some background. You're going to get a lot more of it. Those years are largely about the perfection of propaganda, or if you prefer, public relations, which is, of course, the way that you can move millions of people in unison, as well as about the shift from coal to oil and natural gas and nuclear energy, and of how those new sources of energy have changed the earth and have made the United States the superpower that it claims to be. As I wrote in Imperial San Francisco, families with names such as Rockefeller and Guggenheim, and I might have added Bush and Walker, made New York the new Rome, and like the Roman generals returning from Spain with booty, such dynasties provide the plebs with a spectacle of immense wealth brought home from distant lands, as well as suspicions of transnational conspiracies necessary to get it. Yet the fountain of wealth, power, and glamour that issues from the mine and the oil well has also decisively shaped the way we perceive and treat our planet, not as a farm, let alone as a garden, but as a minehead and a battlefield. Don't take it from me. Here's Teddy Roosevelt in 1906, when we still had presidents with brains. "Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government, owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. To destroy this invisible government, to befoul the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmanship of the day." Pretty good words coming from a president in 1906. The first task of this regime is to indissolubly wed corrupt business and corrupt politics. And the dictionary definition of that form of government is, of course, fascism. In the 3+ years, which now seems an eternity, since a blatantly partisan Supreme Court turned over government to the loser and threw him to the oil industry and a sort of American Taliban, which, by the way, Margaret Atwood foresaw in her prophetic novel, The Handmaid's Tale, and I recommend that all of you rent the movie and see the Republic of Gilead, to which we are, in fact, headed. In that time, immense and possibly irreparable damage has been done to constitutional law in this country, to international law, and especially to the terrestrial environment. This is anything but a conservative administration. It's the most radical regime in U.S. history. And its ruthless goals are there in the policy papers, which you're going to hear about, which call for full-spectrum dominance of planet Earth, no matter what the cost to you and me and everything else that we value on this planet. It's all about securing more energy for the United States and its eternally no-fault ally Israel, while ignoring for as long as possible what the use of that energy is going to do to render our planet uninhabitable very soon. I'm here, as I'm sure most of you are, to try to learn what actually happened on the morning of 9/11, because up to now, we have not been allowed to know, as the survivors' families have tried to point out. I say this knowing that I will immediately lose my credibility, because we have been led to believe that here, everything is out in the open, and that if you did not see it on CNN or Fox or read it in Time or Times, then it just didn't happen. Anyone who suggests otherwise, for example, that the plane crash of a liberal senator hated by the present administration, which was simply a timely incident that helped to throw the Congress entirely to the present illegitimate regime, might be anything other than an unfortunate accident, not worth much more than 2 days, maybe three, of news coverage. That person must be a raving fruitcake. Conspiracies just don't happen in this country, all evidence to the contrary. Like the inability of this country to do any wrong, that idea has been firmly implanted in the minds of millions of Americans as armor plate against questions that should be asked about what happened that morning. All evidence to the contrary. There was a conspiracy that should concern us here very much, because it is much more serious than the previous conspiracy of Watergate in its implications for constitutional rule. It's called Iran-Contra, and in its brief hour squirming in the spotlight, it began to reveal some very ugly things about how a small cabal of totalitarian-minded crooks, lowlifes, and thugs with contempt for the Constitution took it upon themselves, or were ordered to do so, to run a secret government out of the basement of the White House. Among many other things, we learned in the hearings that summer that drugs were being flown into this country with no need to worry about interception by the FDA or anyone else, because it had apparently been taken care of higher up. But like a bad dream that evaporates quickly upon awakening, Iran-Contra has faded into the distant past. And when I try to teach it, I find that for young people these days, it's about as relevant as the Battle of Hastings. Ronald Reagan, called to testify, couldn't remember a thing. And who would want to press that kindly old uncle, anyway, about how he could have possibly remained ignorant about the magma that was percolating just below his Oval Office? When Bush Sr. became president, he pardoned the major participants, such as Cap Weinberger, making them unindicted co-conspirators, which I've always thought was an odd term since we don't have conspiracies here. And then his son sealed the records to historians so that we will probably never know what happened, because I suspect that the present regime is editing those records as they regularly do websites and scientific reports that come to conclusions that are not contained in the Old Testament. John Ashcroft, all the time it's happening. John Ashcroft, of course, instructed federal agencies that they need not honor Freedom of Information Act, and the so-called Justice Department would go to bat for them in stonewalling. Bush and Cheney then appointed most of those unindicted co-conspirators to the highest positions in their administration. Why have a secret government operating out of the basement when you can have one operating upstairs in broad daylight, since the Congress is willing to abdicate its responsibilities and the mass media will not point this out, except when John Poindexter goes a little gaga and proposed total surveillance of U.S. citizens and a betting pool in terrorism futures. That's right. This is a government fundamentally run by criminals who once before subverted the Constitution in order to achieve their own imperial ends in Latin America and elsewhere. They're just doing it in the open now because they know that they can get away with it. And they understand far better than most Americans just how essential energy is for full-spectrum domination and for further enriching themselves. This is by far the most secretive administration ever. It really makes Richard Nixon look like a rank amateur by comparison. And I think it's so secretive because it has so very much to hide. And the press has, for the most part, been complicit in allowing it to get away with its constant daily subversion. Few are aware that investigative journalism is a dying, if not altogether dead, activity in this country. One of the very few who carries it on is Bill Moyers. And I would say that Bill Moyers, at the time of Iran-Contra, produced an absolutely splendid documentary called High Crimes and Misdemeanors. And had anybody taken that seriously, Reagan and Bush would have subsequently been in prison, but the mainline media completely ignored the conclusions of that. KQED shows how much it values Moyers' show, called Now, by scheduling it for the Siberian time slot of 10 p.m. on Friday and bumping it to later whenever that educational television station has the chance to broadcast 4 hours of Susie Orman's The Courage to be Rich or a retrospective of the Bee Gees. Cancel your subscriptions! I said that the United States was the product of the 18th century Enlightenment. What we are seeing in the 21st century is what I call the Great Endarkenment. Let me end, then, by going back to Mesopotamia less than a year ago, as U.S. forces shocked and awed Iraqis and moved into Baghdad. In less than a week, Baghdad's National Museum was looted and trashed. And then, of course, you heard that they'd found all the stuff and it was all okay, but that's not really true. You heard about that. But did you hear that Mosul's museum was also trashed, and it was pretty good, and that Iraq's universities were sacked and burned, and that its great archaeological sites continue to be looted to this day? Moreover, the Iraq National Library and the great Quranic Library were burned while American soldiers were ordered to guard the records in the oil ministry. As reported by Robert Fisk, I would scarcely know about it otherwise because the Chronicle didn't feel that this destruction merited an article of its own, and most people have never heard of it. And then we moved on to other things, like the president's landing on an aircraft carrier to announce that the mission had been accomplished. And I wondered if Leni Riefenstahl was dead at that time, because it sure looked like she choreographed the whole thing. We moved on. Since we are a young nation, ever fixed on the future and immune to error, oblivious that we had just permitted the trashing of the irreplaceable records of the very foundations of civilization itself in our would-be campaign to save civilization. And we feel that the Iraqis should just get over it, along with the deaths of countless Iraqis and the destruction of their property. They should just get over it as we got over the coup d'etat of 2000. Or as I'm sure that we would get over the burning of the Library of Congress and the New York Public Library and Harvard Library and the Metropolitan Museum and the National Gallery and the Frick Gallery and the Chicago Art Institute and the Getty Museum within 4 days. It's really not that important, is it? And besides, we're getting rid of our libraries anyway because we can't afford them anymore. Are we just a little unclear on the concept of civilization, perhaps? At least those in the White House are. There's a great deal that those who have taken over Washington do not want you to know about what has been done and is being done in your name and the great danger to which those actions are exposing us all in order to get yet more energy and to build yet greater fortunes for themselves and for their colleagues. That's why I call this period the Great Endarkenment, and it is perhaps the greatest of all betrayals of the founding ideals of this nation, and the monopolized mass media shares a great deal of responsibility for propagating this giddy ignorance and this justified fear of what is to come. So in the next several days, let us shine some light now into that darkness while we still can. Thank you very much.
That was historian Gray Brecken, author of Imperial San Francisco, speaking on March 26th in San Francisco. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're listening to presentations from the International Inquiry on 9/11. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio,